Welcome to the Buddha Sasana Podcast. This talk was given by Bhikkhu Chintita in Austin, Texas.
Today I want to continue talking about harmony, how we avoid in human affairs discord, ruffled feathers, infighting, argument, insult, exploitation, violence, and war. Social responsibilities. Two other conditions of harmony in the Buddha's thought have to do with how we fulfill our social roles and what we expect of others concerning their social roles. Where fulfillment and expectation are in accord, harmony generally results. We're reciting further the Sigalowada Sutta, which we began discussing last week. We find that each of the six quarters actually corresponds to two reciprocal roles, each of which carries five responsibilities, except for six responsibilities according to monastics in the last case. In five ways, a child should minister to his parents as the East. Having supported me, I shall support them. I shall do their duties. I shall keep my family tradition. I shall make myself worthy of my inheritance. And furthermore, I shall offer alms in honor of my departed relatives. In five ways, the parents, thus ministered to as the East by their children, show their compassion. They restrain them from evil. They encourage them to do good. They train them for a profession. They arrange a suitable marriage. At the proper time, they hand over their inheritance to them. In these five ways do children minister to their parents as the East, and the parents show their compassion to their children. Thus is the East covered by them and made safe and secure. In five ways, a pupil should minister to a teacher as the South, by rising from his seat in salutation, by attending on him, by eagerness to learn, by personal service, by respectful attention while receiving instructions. In five ways do teachers thus ministered to, as the South by their pupils, show their compassion. They train them in the best discipline. They see that they grasp their lessons well. They instruct them in the arts and sciences. They introduce them to their friends and associates. They provide for their safety in every quarter. The teachers thus ministered to as the South by their pupils show their compassion toward them in these five ways. Thus is the South covered by them and made safe and secure. In five ways should a wife, as the West, be ministered to by a husband, by being courteous to her, by appreciating her, by being faithful to her, by handing over authority to her, and by providing her with adornments. The wife thus ministered to her as the West by her husband shows her compassion to her husband in five ways. She performs her duties well. She's hospitable to relations and attendants. She's faithful. She protects what he brings. She is skilled and industrious in discharging her duties. In these five ways does the wife show her compassion to her husband, who ministers to her as the West. Thus the West is covered by him and made safe and secure. In five ways should a clansman minister to his friends and associates as the North: by liberality, by courteous speech, by being helpful, by being impartial, by sincerity. The friends and associates thus ministered to her as the North by a clansman show compassion to him in five ways. They protect him when he is heedless. They protect his property when he's heedless. They become a refuge when he's in danger. They do not forsake him in his troubles. They show consideration for his family. The friends and associates thus ministered to as the North by a clansman show their compassion toward him in these five ways. Thus is the North covered by him and made safe and secure. In five ways should a master minister to his servants and employees as the Nadir: by assigning them work according to their ability, by supplying them with food and with wages, by tending them in sickness, by sharing with them any delicacies, by granting them leave at times. The servants and employees thus ministered to as the Nadir by their master show their compassion to him in five ways. They rise before him, they go to sleep after him, they take only what is given, they perform their duties well, they uphold his good name and fame. The servants and employees thus ministered to as the Nadir show their compassion toward him in these five ways. Thus is the Nadir covered by him and made safe and secure. In five ways should a householder minister to ascetics and Brahmins as the Zenith: by lovable deeds, by lovable words, by lovable thoughts, by keeping open house to them, by supplying their material needs. The ascetics and Brahmins thus ministered to as the Zenith by a householder show their compassion toward him in six ways. They restrain him from evil. They persuade him to do good. They love him with a kind heart. They make him hear what he has not heard. They clarify what he has already heard. They point out the path to a heavenly state. In these six ways do ascetics and Brahmins show their compassion toward a householder who ministers to them as the Zenith. Thus is the Zenith covered by him and made safe and secure. I quote this at length because of the importance of this teaching. It provides what we could consider a fourth system of ethics alongside generosity, precepts, and purity, although elements of all three of these are found in this itemization of responsibilities, that is, like precepts, a kind of duty ethics, a code of obligations. However, like the Confucian Code, its focus is on the harmonization or ordering of human affairs. This is often referred to as a lay winia, corresponding to the monastic code of conduct. We can note a few qualities of this system of responsibility. First, it is balanced, allocating more or less equal responsibilities to each side of each reciprocal relation. In this way, it's not exploitive as long as all adhere to their own responsibilities. I think the point is that if the reciprocal relation is out of balance, as when employees or wives are simply treated as property, harmony suffers. Second, this itemization focuses on responsibilities, not on rights. A common modern tendency is to see the social landscape in terms of my rights, but their responsibilities. Finally, although the specifics might require some adaptation to modern social relations, this allocation of responsibilities still applies remarkably well and very critically to our modern circumstances. The ideal society. An important conditioning factor in communal harmony or disharmony that goes beyond individual interactions and relations is certainly governance or the institutional structures of the society. This also was not beyond the Buddha's purview, for the Buddha was the architect of a community, the Sangha of monks and nuns. It's instructive to see what kinds of choices the Buddha made to form this ideal society writ small. In Gotama's time, the Gangetic Plain encompassed a number of small kingdoms and republics. The two dominant kingdoms of the region were Magadha and Kosala. The republics were largely lined up along the northern edge of the Gangetic Plain in the foothills of the Himalayan mountains, which were coming increasingly under the dominance of the kingdoms. The westernmost of these was the Sakyan Republic, where the Buddha-to-be grew up. These republics were generally governed by unelected assemblies of elders from the Khatiya, or warrior administrative class. It's likely that the Buddha, as a Khatiya, was familiar with matters of governance. This was also a patriarchal society that would become more patriarchal with time, such that spiritual practice and education were widely, though not entirely, considered masculine pursuits, and women were generally subject in all stages of life to masculine authority. Although there were ascetics in India before the Buddha, among all the bodies of renouncers, it was only the Buddhists who invented monastic life, that is, who provided an organized institution capable of sustaining its practice and teachings. The Buddha never attempted to organize the lay community in this way, except indirectly by putting the monastic community in their midst and letting them sort out what to do about it. The monastic Sangha is a multifunctional institution defined in the Vinaya with a mission statement, a code of conduct, rules of governance, guidelines for handling grievances, and many other features. Some of the notable hallmarks of the Sangha, as conceived by the Buddha, are as follows. The Sangha observes no class distinctions and an exemplary level of gender equality. It's regulated in a way to avoid conflicts and maintain harmony, and observes procedures to negotiate disagreements should these arise. It rules by consensus of all monastics in a local community, and as such is only minimally hierarchical. For instance, there's no system of pope and bishops, so that although monastics live under the code of the Vinaya, they are not subject to any distant centralized authority. Serious transgressions of the monastic code entail no corporal punishments, but rather sanctions, none more severe than expulsion from the local community. Rectifying transgressions is much dependent on acknowledgement of guilt. Committing one of the most serious offenses, for instance, killing another person, is simply, by definition, no longer to be a monastic. If one hides the offense, one is impersonating a monastic. Aside from limited coercive control over each other, Monastics have no coercive power whatever over the laity. There is, for instance, nothing like excommunication. Their authority derives entirely from the respect they receive as teachers and role models for those committed to the dhammic life. In practice, the laity has significant coercive power over the sangha, since a displeased laity can at any time withdraw the support on which the sangha depends on a daily basis. The constitution of the Sangha embodies so many social ideals that it might seem rather pie in the sky. But keep in mind that the Sangha has outlived every other contemporaneous institution and almost everyone that has arisen since. It has seen great empires come and go and yet persists fully intact to this day. This is evidence of the profound and practical comprehension of social factors that the Buddha brought to bear as he carefully constituted the monastic Sangha. He created something unprecedented, something that just keeps going. The Buddha did not actively champion the similar reformation of civil society, but did have a bit to say about responsibilities of kings towards their subjects, sometimes describing the righteous or wheel-turning king as a kind of ideal. For instance, he recommended that such a king seek ethical guidance from wise monastics or ascetics. Whatever ascetics and Brahmins in your kingdom have renounced the life of sensual infatuation and are devoted to forbearance and gentleness, each one taming himself, each one calming himself, and each one striving for the end of craving, from time to time you should go to them and consult them as to what is wholesome and what is unwholesome, what is blameworthy and what is blameless, what is to be followed and what is not to be followed, and what action will, in the long run, lead to harm and sorrow, and what to welfare and happiness. Having listened to them, you should avoid evil and do what is good. This is quite a bit different than depending on corporate lobbyists for advice. This passage is significant in view of the common understanding that monastics should not get involved in political or social matters and are perhaps ill-equipped to do so. It clearly opens a nonpartisan role for them as moral advisors. The practice of harmony. The skill of harmonizing with others is developed on top of skills of generosity, harmlessness, and purity. It adds to these the specialized skill of dealing with the complexities of the common human personality as we interact with others, including respect for their humanness and acknowledgement of a conditioned complex of faults and virtues that we all possess, aside from the arahants among us. It also adds to these a handle on some of your more deeply rooted inclinations, for we commonly reserve a particularly pronounced capacity for harshness for our fellow humans. As you practice harmony, you may often be frustrated at the limits of your own control over the consequences. Harmony is something shared by people in relationship or in community, yet you exercise some degree of control over only one side of the relationship and over one locus in the dynamics of a community. The best you can do is uphold, in your practice and from your side, the conditions conducive to harmony and leave the rest up to others who may have entirely different understandings and less pure intentions than your own. Recall that your practice and its results are your own. That way you at least do not contribute to the disharmony when it arises in spite of your best intentions. and you may even set a good example for others. You must take care as the urge arises to control a particular situation through admonishing others, for unless this is done with great skill, this risks still greater disharmony. There are ways, however, in which you can influence others in the direction of greater harmony. For one thing, when others begin to realize that you consistently refuse to participate in the kinds of social behaviors that precipitate disharmony, such as responding to insult with insult, you become a kind of refuge for them from such behavior, a safe place in which they don't have to be so defensive. And soon they begin to emulate your behaviors. You may become a role model, sometimes of significant influence. Monastics tend to wield particular influence of this kind because of the deference traditionally accorded to them. Also, within any culture, certain people enjoy a degree of authority in relationship to others as wise advisors or teachers, either by social role or reputation. Parents, teachers, and ascetics and Brahmins may enjoy this status. Granting reverence or veneration to another is an act of trust or faith that opens you up to their influence, making them a role model, sometimes of astonishing influence. The Buddha, to take the primary example, certainly received that degree of veneration from his thousands of disciples, and thereby gained the right freely to admonish many others. It's only through granting this level of respect or trust to the wise that the Buddhist movement, the sasana, has grown. Likewise, monastics traditionally enjoy this authority born of respect in Buddhist cultures. Respect and veneration in the Buddhist context is the topic of the next two talks. As you interact with others, a range of unskillful thoughts will likely come up involving anger, resentment, envy, arrogance, vanity, personal insult, conceit, and so on. In the practice of purification, you gradually let go of your tendency towards such thoughts. Your first line of defense is not to act bodily or verbally on the basis of such thoughts as they continue to arise, to remain physically and verbally harmless, whatever the mind might be doing. If you can do this, you are already to a degree accomplished in not contributing to disharmony. Precepts about speech in particular, not speaking falsely, not speaking harshly, not speaking divisively, and not speaking frivolously, will take you far in this direction. One of the most dangerous ways you can act on the basis of such thoughts is through divisive speech. It's helpful to guard against this with a further rule of thumb. Do not speak ill of others at all. There will be cases in which this rule of thumb cannot be sustained, for instance, where you need to warn others out of compassion of the sailor of dubious intent around the corner who is swigging rum, swearing, and brandishing a cutlass. But consider that, in general, speaking ill of others is generally a huge responsibility. First, in the situation where it's likely to come up, you may well be speaking falsely or repeating rumors. If there is anger involved, there will almost certainly be some degree of misperception on your part and therefore bias in what you communicate. Second, the consequences of your speech might easily get out of hand, even if you are speaking truthfully. Even if your intentions are relatively pure, how about the intentions of those you speak to, who are likely to repeat it to others, and so forth? Furthermore, if you're talking with someone who lacks familiarity with the person or group of which you speak ill, what is said is likely to become their dominant impression for a long time to come. The hearer of such disparagement may then repeat it much less skillfully than you have and with quite impure intentions. Third, it's difficult to maintain kindness in a mob. Even if you speak ill of another in all kindness for that person, others who happen to agree with you may be of questionable kindness. Another rule of thumb: never take sides in interpersonal disputes. Even if you are friends with one party, don't become part of a coalition set in opposition to some other person or group. It's advisable to become open to, familiar with, and demonstrative of gestures of respect and general etiquette in whatever local Buddhist community you might belong to. It should be noted that although these go back to common Indian roots in virtually every Buddhist community, these have evolved into somewhat different forms through different Asian cultures. It's also wise to become skilled in the modern gestures of etiquette of the prevailing culture. Although these are generally different from those found in most Buddhist communities, they generally serve much the same function.